One of the beauties of this podcast, and I've said this before on many occasions, is that I've been able to connect with fathers from all different walks of life. And they all have their own unique stories to tell. And that just goes to show us that fatherhood is not a singular thing. Everyone has their own way of doing things. Everyone has their own approach to fatherhood. And everyone's story in their personal life, which has a direct effect on their fathering approach, is different. And today's guest is a perfect example of that, and he has a great story to tell. So Charles King will be joining me today. I'm Jamar Hudson, and this is the Fatherhood Podcast. Welcome to the Fatherhood Podcast. I'm your host, Jamar Hudson, and you're in the Fatherhood. As a new member of the Hood, my goal is to use this podcast as a platform to talk about my journey as a new father. Part therapeutic, part informative, part educational. My goal is to talk about everything, from adjusting to getting no sleep, to changing diapers, to just hoping I get everything right. This podcast will be a space to share with you the joys, challenges, and fears of being a first-time father. Well, man, I really appreciate you joining me on the podcast today. Before we dive deep into the discussion, just to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
I'm Charles King Jr., born and raised in Washington, D.C. I'm a 38-year-old male, father of one child, is 15 years old. Lived in D.C. my whole life, been in trouble a few times. And over the last 5 years, I've returned to the community, and I've been pretty much an asset to the community in any form or fashion, whether it's with my organization or in the line of work that I'm in.
You mentioned your son right there, man. I want to kind of stay right there. So tell us about him, and what does being a father mean to you?
Well, to speak on him is a two-parted question. So to speak on him, great child, have no complaints, right? Very, very intelligent, all A student, in robotics and band, have no complaints. Like I'm truly blessed. And I don't say that in the magnitude of, because it's my child. I say that because, as you know, from previous conversation and from, you know, the knowledge that you have, I actually work with youth. So I get to see youth in every shape or form, just in his age group. And, I know that I got a unique child just from my dealings with kids. But what does he mean to me? What does it mean to me to be a parent? Like, he means the world to me in all actuality. And to be his parent is a great thing to me. It's like one of the highlights of my life.
That's awesome, man. So how did fatherhood, and we're going to dive into your story a little bit later, but how did it change you and your outlook on life in general?
Well, with being a father, it's a great responsibility. And I understand that, you know, it was a responsibility that I take very serious. You know, some people just make kids and, you know, they're not really there as fathers. For me, I think that it's a great responsibility that I take very serious. And it changed me. It changed me in a multitude of ways because I understand that I'm responsible for me and someone else now. And I'm responsible for the well-being of that person, whether it's mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, or any form of fashion.
Yeah, man, and that's great, man. Now, Charles, you have a very interesting story of ups and downs that you've experienced in your life, getting to you to where you are now in terms of the great work you're doing in community. So take our listeners a little bit through your background and some of the trials you've experienced up until this current point.
Well, first of all, I was initially born with a birth defect, so I came into the world with an issue from the time that I was, you know, pushed out of my mother's womb into the world. So just coming into the world, I was born with a birth defect on my foot. And pretty much from there, I dealt with that growing up, coming from being an infant to, you know, a toddler. And you know, I was able to overcome that. But I grew up in Washington, D.C. during the 80s and the 90s. And it was a different era of what it is now, what is people's calling it gentrification, right? Mm-hmm. It was an era of maybe, say, 400,000, 500,000 people. The city was 70% black. And, you know, the economics wasn't here like they were. So, of course, when the drug epidemic hit the United States, it hit my city as hard as it hit anywhere else, right? So I grew up during that era. During that era growing up, I seen a lot of things. I've heard a lot of things. And I know of a lot of things that, you know, for many who come from where I come from, such as myself, it desensitized things to us and made certain things normal. So I grew up in an era where, say, it was 500 murders in a year, 400, 500 murders in a year in Washington. Then when you calculate in Prince George's County, it was probably another 300. So we're talking about an average of 700 to 800 murders a year that we're seeing, you know, randomly on the news. So I grew up with that. And throughout the early parts of my life, I was incarcerated, and I went to the juvenile facility at 13. I entered the facility at 13, and upon entering the facility and dealing with that adjudication, I was placed in a group home. After being placed in a group home, I was returned back to my mother after being in the group home for about 2 years. After getting out of the group home, 6 months after getting out of the group home, I was actually shot. So when I got shot, I was shot in my spine, I was shot in my leg, and I was shot in my buttocks. The bullet in my buttocks actually went to my stomach and messed up some of my intestines, and the one in my spine paralyzed me from the waist down.
Wow. Wow.
So I actually went through that situation and did inpatient therapy at National Rehabilitation Hospital here in Washington, D.C. After doing that rehab and maybe a year or so learning how to walk again, I was right back into the streets. So I wound up getting rearrested again. And with that cycle of being rearrested again, you know, I went through that process, and I was returned back to the community. When I returned back to the community, you know, my life choices really didn't change for the most part. I just got older, and, you know, my choices got more bolder. So I continued to, you know, indulge in what would be considered criminal activity in the street life. And during that time of being in the street and living my life or whatever, maybe in the year of 2002, November, not even maybe, in the year 2002, close to the time that we're having this interview, or maybe 2 or 3 days before Thanksgiving, I actually found my mother murdered. Mm. And, you know, that like just really did something to me. I never really had a chance to process that, because within 6 months after finding my mother murdered, which we never knew who did it, never got no closure or anything to that, I was arrested on a federal, I was charged in federal court with a federal indictment and went to trial and wound up ultimately being convicted and sent off to federal prison, which I served a sentence of 13 years and 2 months.
Yeah, yeah. So let me just interrupt you, Charles, and we'll pick it back up here in a second. But during this period of time in the 80s and 90s, as you mentioned, growing up in what we call old DC, what if any type of male role models or father figures did you have growing up?
Well, prior to the crack era, it was a lot of stable households. If I could detail it or structure it in that way, right? I lived in Northwest. I grew up on a place on a street called Homey Place in Northwest Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. It's a residential area. Everyone knew everyone on my street for the most part, right? Like, my parents grew up with all the other parents that was on our street. So, like, we was the kids of the generation that came before us.
Right.
So we knew everybody. So, you know, the structure was there. But as soon as I started getting a little bit older, and hit before I hit like preteens, the crack era came, and a lot of families was wiped out behind that, right? A lot of mothers, fathers, you know, things just fell apart. It just came and took the neighborhood by storm, right? I watched parents that was once, you know, I would say, you know, professionals or people that you might have respect for lose all dignity and respect. So for me, with the parent element, especially from a father standpoint, because my father was around, but my father also fell victim to the crack epidemic also as becoming an addict.
Mm-hmm.
So I seen a lot of men, but the men that I actually seen that gave me insight or gave me advice, they was the drug dealers in the neighborhood.
Right.
Not that they told me to sell drugs. It was just more so that, hey, you know, like you got to be tough. Be prepared for this. Know this. And some things wasn't verbal. Some things was seen. Some things you just picked up by watching and understanding that this is how this go.
Right. So let's pick it back up. You talked about your mother's death, and you talked about being indicted and going back to prison around that time. So let's pick up your story right there.
So I'm sent to federal prison. Before I even got to federal prison, getting my indictment and, you know, going through the process of the judicial system of the court proceedings or whatever, I was, you know, made aware that my son had been conceived. So actually, my son's mother was pregnant with my son during the time of me initially getting arrested. I had found out that she was pregnant while I was incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, fast forward, I wound up going to trial on multiple occasions. After the second trial, I was convicted. So maybe 3 months after I got convicted, 2 months after I got convicted, excuse me, I was convicted in December of 2003. In February of 2004, my son was born.
Mm.
So I initially had my first interaction and contact with my son inside of an institution visiting home.
Mm.
So, I got as many contact visits while I was still local as possible, because once I was sentenced, I was sent all the way to Kentucky.
Yeah.
So I didn't have that access to my child as, you know, as conveniently as, say, being in D.C. and D.C. jail or CTF, the Central Treatment Facility, right? So I got to Kentucky and I stayed there for a little while. But after being in Kentucky, I was eligible for a transfer. So I put in and was transferred to Maryland.
Yeah,
which was Cumberland FCI, federal institution there.
Right.
And, you know, I started seeing my son while I was there. And by this time, he had developed to the point that he was walking. He wasn't, you know, using the bathroom on his own, but he was walking. You know, he was maybe 1.5, something like that.
Yeah. So let me just interrupt you a little bit, right, Charles? I want to paint this picture for our listeners. You find out you're going to be a father around the same time where you're about to, you know, head off the prison. What was that emotional roller coaster like? You know, what was your mindset like, you know, finding out that you're going to be a dad, but you're not going to be able to be there?
Well, initially finding out, you know, due to the fact that I was still in the process of what people would say, you know, litigating the case, but, you know, in layman terms, and fighting the case.
Yeah.
But during the time of litigating the case or whatever, my intentions was, hey, I can't go to jail. I need to get out of here for my son.
Yeah.
I need to get out of here. Well, initially, I didn't know what the gender was. I need to get out of here. I'm about to have a baby, right? That's my responsibility. So that was kind of partially part of my fight of why I even fought, you know, to even begin with. So that mental is really unexplainable for a person who's responsible. Like, prison wasn't an option at the mm-hmm. moment. Like, I'm not going to prison. And if I go to prison, y'all gonna have to haul me off to prison. I'm not just volunteering to go. So that was kind of like my mental upon finding out that I had a child on the way.
Right. So you end up going to prison. Take me through, you know, that the time you served and how you were able to, or how did you approach being a father while in prison? How did that work?
Well, in the federal prisons, in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, we're only allocated 300 minutes a month
mm-hmm.
for the phone, no matter what. Prepaid or collect, you're only getting 300 minutes a month. And that applies to everyone there. With the exception of November and December, you get an extra additional 100 minutes for the holidays. So technically, if you break that down, if you got 30 days in a month, you can use the phone. If you break it down in that magnitude, that's 10 minutes a day.
Yeah. So,
multiple times throughout the week, I will always call home and talk to my child.
Mm-hmm.
I will always call home and talk to my child. When I had the opportunity, I would take pictures and send them home to my child. And as my child started to develop, you know, and he was able to identify and recognize things, you know, I always made sure that I called, hey, do you need anything? Do you want anything? How are things going with you? And once we started having that bond through phone calls and through visitation, you know, the bond was established. He got to know me to a certain degree due to the stipulations and the restrictions that was put on me when I was incarcerated.
So how did you present that? I mean, obviously, this was all he knew from birth that, you know, his dad was behind bars. But how did you present that to him, the situation that you were in?
Well, you know, I told him that, you know, I'm locked up. Well, evidently, he knows that I'm locked up.
Yeah.
He's not, you know, these phone calls are coming through. And, you know, people talk. we're not going to even take that out of the equation. People talk, and people and kids recognize,
right,
whether you realize or not. Sometimes we say stuff, and we say, "Hey, don't even know what we're talking about." Well, nowadays kids recognize a lot of different things.
Right.
So we never really had a discussion when I was incarcerated about, you know, my offense, my purpose, or my reason for being there. You know, it was just, I'm dad.
Yeah.
No, when he came, it was just, I'm dad, come in, love you, give me a hug, what's going on with you, how is school, you know, you staying out of trouble, what you know new, tell me what you know new, or, you know, I found out maybe through speaking to a family member or his mom that, hey, something new that he's doing. So when he comes, I surprise, hey, well, you know how to do such and such, you know how to sing such and such, so sing it for me, right?
Right, right.
You know, the things that a typical dad would do if he was coming in the house on a daily basis, and your wife or your, or you know, on a mother or your child or your significant other in some form or fashion told you, hey, your child just jumped up and sung the new Bruno Mars song, right?
Right.
You know, typical parents, hey, sing that song for me. So it was sort of like that. Even if I did it over the phone sometimes, even I can remember back as far as him learning his ABCs and being on the phone, and you know, his mom telling me, he knows ABCs, and when he gets the phone, hey, say your ABCs, and him saying it to
right.
me. You know, verbatim over the phone.
So you try to keep it as normal a relationship as possible, given the circumstances.
Most definitely. Like, I never allowed where I was at or my situation to hinder me being a parent, because, like, even though I was incarcerated, I just wasn't there physically.
Right.
When you start talking about financially, like, financially, the whole time I was incarcerated, I made sure that I did my part. When
right.
it was school time, he had school clothes. When it was birthdays, he had birthdays. When it was Christmas, he had Christmas. When it was summer, he had summer clothes. I made sure those things happened, you know, in whatever form or fashion I had to make sure that they happened. You know, like sometimes it might be a sacrifice on my behalf, but it was happening.
Right. And the reason I ask that, man, and I want you to kind of address this and answer this for our listeners, is there are some misconceptions, you know, about fathers who are in prison and doing some time. You kind of are the opposite to that. So just talk to me a little bit about those misconceptions that the general public may have about fathers who are serving time while being a father at the same time.
Well, a man is a man. We are who we are before we walk into anywhere.
Right.
Before I walk into an institution, before I walk into a house, I am who I am. The place doesn't define us, right? So, and I'm going to use this analogy as an example. You send a man to jail and he doesn't try to fend for his child, or, you know, he doesn't make no attempt to, you know, to connect with his child. That's pretty much who that man was before he went to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Because prison don't make you nobody. It just exposes who you are. So I think one of the biggest misconceptions about men that's incarcerated is that we neglect our responsibilities when we go to jail, or we don't care. It's like we just relinquish all of our responsibilities, and that's not the case. Some people are not in a situation to take care of their child, so they do whatever they can do, whether it's, hey, if I got to draw you a card and send it to you, or send you a picture, or, you know, whatever I can do from here, I do it. People tend to think that because a person is locked up, that they just relinquish all of their responsibilities, and I think that's the biggest misconception with any person that's put in prison. I mean, when we go off to prison as a man, a lot of us went off to prison, several men that I know, for trying to provide for their family.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the reason I'm here is trying to make it better for my child. So you think I'm just going to go in here and just completely forget it out, trying to make it better?
Yeah, yeah. So what was the hardest part for you during that process, knowing you had a son who's growing up, you're missing a lot of things? What was the most difficult part of that for you?
I think the most difficult part was, and this is something that always stuck with me, was really not having the opportunity to have my son meet a lot of my side of my family.
Mm.
Because of he was with his mom. And, you know, sometimes his mom became standoffish about certain things, you know, and it was one particular situation where my grandmother was still alive. And I told her, hey, take him to go see my grandmother, right? And, you know, my grandma was up in age. This is my mother's mother, so mm-hmm. you can imagine how old she was. And I just wanted one picture, right? And, like, take a picture with them together, because that's, like, indelible, right? That's indelible. You'll never capture this again. This can't be replaced. And she didn't do it. And my grandma wound up passing. I think that was the biggest thing I had to deal with while I was incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. So let's fast forward, Charles, and we're talking to Charles King on the podcast today. I'm glad to have him. Let's fast forward, you know, to the time where you're approaching getting released and coming home. Take us through that process.
So now I'm getting closer to getting released. I'm transferred. I'm in a prison in Milan, Michigan, right outside of Detroit, Michigan. I was about 7 hours away, 8 hours away via car ride. One of the last visits I got, my dad brought my son up. And when he came up, you know, they came to visit me. And my father, my pops was like, hey, because at this time, just to give you a pause, because I spoke with my father earlier about him being having an addiction. During my incarceration, he overcame his addiction and got himself together. Mm. And so, you know, he was playing an intricate part in helping me with my child. So he brought my son to this institution, which was the last institution I was currently at serving my prison sentence before being released. And, you know, I was talking to my son, and he's pretty big at this time. He's maybe 10. Getting ready to be 11, or he might have been about 11. I can't remember the date of the actual visit. And I can remember my son and my dad coming in, and my dad saying, hey, man, I'm going to come back up here and see you again. And I told him, don't come and see me no more, because next time y'all see me, I'll be on the street.
Yeah. And what year are we talking now?
This is 2015.
Okay.
This is 2015. Early 2015, because I came home. I went to the halfway house June of 2015.
Okay. So once you released and made that transition back to, back home, what was the transition like for you, being a father who is now present? What was that like for you?
Well, it was a complete learning experience, right? Because we're learning each other. You don't know who I really am. Why? Because I got restrictions. I'm in a visiting hall with a correctional officer who's, you know, pretty much dictating rules and regulations. Now I don't have that restriction. Now I have unrestricted access to you. Not that I came home as a disciplinary or authoritarian type person. Just, hey, this is me. So when I came home, it was more so every time I had free time, I made sure that I got up on and spent it with them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if it was an hour before work, 2 hours before work. If I got the time, and it's time appropriate, I'm going to see my son.
So it sounds like to me it wasn't hard for you to transition or get used to being a father, a present father, with this freedom, as opposed to one who was doing it behind bars.
It was a smooth transition for me because, as I stated earlier, the only thing that was missing for my situation was the fact that I was incarcerated. All other aspects of being a parent, I was there.
Mm-hmm. So what did your son have to get used to? How was it for him?
I think that he just really was like, I think it was kind of more like a weird feeling for him. And it's just only my opinion of my observation. I think that it was kind of like a weird feeling to him. And the only reason I see a weird feeling is because, okay, my dad is home. I know this is my dad, but I really don't know my dad, right? So when I'm coming out and I'm correcting things or I'm telling him things, right, he's never heard these things from me before, right? So these are things that he has to adjust to. And I think that over time, even all the way to the day, I think that he realizes when I tell him something or when I instruct him to do something, or even when I'm reprimanding him for something, right, it's genuine and it's out of love.
Right, right. No, that's great, man. So what lessons did you take from your time behind bars, and maybe – people might not think that you would be able to apply to fatherhood?
I think that in prison with the fatherhood classes that I took and some of the fatherhood visits that I had, I think that those things really helped. Because for me, I wasn't a parent. So I did pick up some information out of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to tell you that I got the best information or the worst information, but I did get some information and I was able to use it, you know, how it should be used that applies to my life.
And anything in particular that stands out?
I think that what I realized from some of the classes that I took and listening to some of the other men in there, one of the biggest things that I realized is allow my child to be who they are, not who I want them to be.
Yeah.
Be patient and really be understanding of what's going on with your child. Really pay attention, right? Like, my observation with my son is very great. Like I really pay attention. I might not say nothing to him, because I don't want to be overbearing or too intrusive, right? Because some things don't call for me to say anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do recognize a lot of things that I sometimes don't speak on.
How open are you now, a few years removed from being home with your son about your experiences leading up to going to prison and during your time served?
I'm very transparent with him. He has never really inquired. I've made, comments to him. I asked him, are you curious or do you want to know? He's not inquisitive in the matter, right? So I'm not going to come and volunteer some information to you that you're really not seeking. Because it's unimportant to a degree. If you're not seeking it, then why should I volunteer it, right? But if he wants to know, there's nothing I'm going to hide from him because he's a young man. And at the end of the day, I believe that me being transparent with him not only might can teach him a lesson, but it strengthens our bond because he has an understanding that we have a relationship and that just as I'm being transparent to him, he can be transparent to me.
That's great, man. So now you're home. You've been home for a few years. Take us through your transition back and how you've been trying to be active and how you are being active in the community.
Well, since I came home, initially coming home, I got me a job. And, I just found my way. I started working and I worked, Giants, initially walking out of prison. I took the first job that was offered to me, humbled myself, no problem. And, I transitioned from that and started working for a beer company, delivering beers. And after that, one day I just riding doing the beer company thing and reached out to a guy that I know and said, hey, man, I don't want to do this no more, man. I'm trying to find another job. And it was like, I don't know if the phone call was meant to happen or supposed to happen or, but he was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go over here to this place, to this group home and reach out to these people and tell them that I sent you. So what I initially started doing as far as with my work in the community with even dealing with youth in any form or fashion was working at a group home. But even before that process of working at the group home, I was already like in the community. If I see somebody need some, if I got it, I got a mentality like, listen, as long as I wake up and apply myself, I'm going to get me some money.
Yeah.
Everybody gets some money every day. If you look in the cup of a homeless person, right? They have a penny in it. They got some money. It might not be a lot.
Yeah.
They can get some money every day, right? So that's my mentality. So since I've been home, I've been consistently applying myself by helping people, reaching out to people, doing what I can do in any form of fashion. And I think that's been a big thing for me since I've been back in the community. Just trying to just help in any form of fashion that I can because it's just who I was and who I am as a person.
So tell us about helping others with life.
Helping Others with Life is a nonprofit 501c3 recognized organization that I'm the president and the founder of, and I'm the owner of. And what that organization is exactly what the name entails, Helping Others with Life. And I actually came up with that name myself, woke up one night and just said, this is going to be the name that I'm going to use for my nonprofit. It was like no big brainstorming or anything because I just felt that name entailed everything that I do. Like, I don't want to be Charles King, the dog rescuer, or Charles King, the homeless shelter person, right? I think that's a universal approach with helping others with life. So what I do with my organization, I reach out in any form of fashion that I see suitable in society or in the community or in any form of fashion and just in help, whether it's as like last night, doing a sleep out at the Covenant House, bringing awareness to the youth homelessness, or like last year, I did youth homelessness last year. I did Let's Go to Ward 8 and pick 3 underserved school Title I schools and speak to some teachers or administrators and have them identify kids for bikes. And I wound up giving out 100 bikes to 100 kids in 3 different schools last year. So it was like a breakdown of something like 33 bikes per school. One school got 34. So that's what my organization pretty much entails for the most part. Like, I have a team of people around me, and we're all assets to each other. So sometimes, you see me doing the work and you see me out there, but sometimes it's really not my play. Sometimes it might be one of my partners say, hey, man, hey, I think that we can do this, or I got this on this. Can you do it or can we do it? And if it makes sense and we got the time and it balance out, we do it.
Great, man. That's awesome, man. I encourage people to look up this organization and support it any way possible. So in terms of fatherhood, getting back to that theme, what do you hope that your son, eventually one day he's going to be a father, hopefully. What do you hope, your experiences and the way you conduct yourself, especially now teach him about manhood and fatherhood?
Well, it's not even a hope. It's something that's already manifested. My son's picked up a lot of my traits, a lot of my positive traits, especially since, you know, I've been home. He's a very observant child. You know, like I said, he's 15. He's very intelligent. One thing I learned about my son is that he's very frugal. He's humble. He's giving. You know, he's very compassionate. And he doesn't have a problem with applying himself to help someone. So, like, the helping others with life element is already embedded in him, not from an organizational standpoint, but from a human standpoint. Because just last week we did the shoe and coat drive. And I was like, hey, we're going to do a shoe and coat drive. You coming? You know, the average kid would be like, man, I don't want to go. It was like, okay, let's go, right? And he didn't complain not one time. And he never came over and said, how much longer we going to be here? When we leaving? So those are the things that I recognize. And I've had my son go to the store before, literally. And this is a real story. I've had him go to the store before. And I might give him $20. And I know this food is, say, $17, right? And he comes back and give me $2 and change. And I'm saying, listen, I know you can count, and I know that I can count. So, like, where's my other dollar? Oh, I gave it to a homeless person. He asked me for a dollar when I was coming out of the store. So I know that, you know, he's picked up a lot of my positive traits.
What is your consistent message, man? Not just to your son, but to other men you come in contact with who know your story, who want to kind of better themselves, especially young fathers. What is your message to them?
Be patient. Be patient. Understand that change isn't rapid, but change is change. Everything is going to change. Now, you can dictate your change, whether it's negative or positive. So make sure that you pick the change that you're seeking. Don't pick the change that you're seeking, but have some other type of actions. Make sure that your actions match up with what you're seeking. Because at the end of the day, you know, as a parent, I mean, the number one thing is to make sure that you're instilling the things that you need to instill. That doesn't ultimately guarantee success, but what it does do is allow you to say that you know that you did your part as a parent. So that's the biggest message that I give to a lot of parents when I'm dealing with them. Be patient with your child and, you know, let your child be their self. You know, I know you wanted to play football or you wanted to be a gangster or whatever you wanted to be, but that might not be your child. So allow your child to be who they are.
Great, man. Last question for you, my man. I really appreciate you joining me. You know, obviously you've been through a lot over the past 10, 15 years. Looking back on your experiences and where you are now, involved in the community, being an active father, how gratifying is it for you having gone through what you've gone through to be where you are now?
It's extremely gratifying, right? I do what I do, and I don't recognize, sometimes I don't recognize the magnitude of what I do. Sometimes I really don't understand the great severity of what I do. So for me to do what I do and not really recognize the severity of what I do is like I'm kind of like thrown off. So I think that It's a big gratitude, but I don't look at it as gratitude. I look at it as me just doing what I'm supposed to do.
Right.
If that makes sense to you. You know, some people come up to me and tell me, man, I appreciate what you're doing. Man, you give me inspiration. You motivate me. Whatever it may be, you know, and I never get any negative feedback, you know, at least not to my face for the things that I do. And sometimes I have to process it. It's in hindsight that I really sit down and process the fact of where I'm at in life and what I'm doing. Because like I said, I do what I do just because like it's supposed to be done. It's just like waking up in the morning and cooking breakfast. And somebody say, man, I love the way you are with your child. Man, I see you cook breakfast from every morning. Well, I think that he needs to eat, right? That's normal, but it's not normal because a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah. Well, man, look, I appreciate you joining me on the podcast today. Before I let you go, tell people how they can get in touch with you, how they can learn more about your organization.
Charles King, I'm on Instagram. My Instagram is Helping Others with Life. I have a web page. It's howldmv.com. Howl, HOWLDMV.com. If you link on, click on any of those, I'm findable. If you DM me, if you click on there, I want to say that my phone number is listed on there, that I'm findable. And if you reach out to me and we can collaborate in any form or fashion, you know, I'm open for it. And if we can't, I'm open for discussion and maybe point you in the right direction. You can point me in the right direction.
My man, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
I appreciate you having me.
I want to thank my man Charles King for joining me today. You've been listening to the Fatherhood Podcast. You can find this episode and previous conversations on all major streaming platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. Be sure to follow the show on Instagram at the Fatherhood Podcast and like the Fatherhood Podcast page on Facebook. And as always, if you like what you hear, please just be sure to leave a rating and review. Until next time, I'm Jamar Hudson, and this is the Fatherhood Podcast.